Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 123 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Summer's shaking her head like, holy crap.
No, I'm shaking my head like, still. We are still in love with all things Outlander after 123 episodes.
I know, that's saying something, isn't it? It's like, you, for the most part, can still stand me, and I, for the most part, can still stand you, but we still are monkey loving all over Outlander.
I would like to go on the record as saying I monkey love nothing.
Hey, no. Me either.
Except my monkeys. You monkey love whatever you want. I'm going to monkey love. I mean, you can keep monkey loving whatever you want. I will keep it strictly to the human race.
Okay, that's a little bit far, but.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. So, don't you open your mouth this week. Don't interrupt me. This week on the read-along, we're going to start with chapter 34, entitled The Postman Always Rings Twice. And depending upon how much Ginger has to say about this chapter, we may be able to cover two chapters. We're prepared for two.
We will.
Is it going to be that brief?
I'm not saying anything. All I'm saying is we will get through two chapters.
Okay. Then everyone be prepared. I will introduce chapter 35 when we get there. But let's start with chapter 34. The postman always rings twice.
So the postman. I've only had one sip of whiskey, by the way. The postman always rings twice. Also, the royal prick.
That's not part of the title.
It's part of my title.
Oh.
So we have a lot of commentary. So let's go get your favorite drinks or drink or snack or whatever and sit back and relax. And we hope, wow, that was a cat that flew. This cat just appeared behind Summer's head.
It was pretty awesome. Okay, this is all I'm going to say at this point. I don't ever see Ginger's notes or the contributor notes before this goes in. I'm just going to say that I have something very specific to say about
the royal prick.
No, about the mail that comes.
So the royal prick?
Kind of, I guess. Oh, anyway, that sounds so bad.
Oh, it does.
Anyway, my point is I'm going to be a little sad if one of our contributors...
Oh, they probably did.
If they said what I want to say.
They're probably going to steal your thunder. And that's awesome because our listeners...
are, like, amazing.
Our contributors are like, okay, all of our listeners are kick-ass, but our contributors are redonkulous.
I'm just saying... what I have to say is so very specific and personal that I'm going to be a little hurt if somebody steals it from me.
If it's personal, it shouldn't be taken from
you. We'll see. It's personal to me, but it's also personal to many other people, I'm sure. We'll see.
Okay.
I'm going to interrupt. If you come out and say what I want to say, I'm going to interrupt you.
Point it out.
Okay, it's coming. Go.
Okay.
The postman always rings twice.
Or the royal prick.
Oh my God, stop.
I'm going to start the conversation with something because it has to do with the chapter title. So Connie writes, the postman always rings twice may mean, she gives a few kind of references. So it's a 1934 crime novel by James M. Cain. There was a film in 1946 of the same name, a drama film noir based on the novel, and in 1981 of the same name, and then a drama based on the novel. Excuse me, the drama? Was based on the novel. The drama was from 1981. And then an opera of the same name from 1982 based on the novel. So this novel has gotten a lot of mileage. Connie writes, regarding the novel, nowhere in the novel does a postman appear, nor is one even alluded to.
But if he had been there, he would have rung twice.
The title's meaning has therefore often been the subject of speculation. William Marling, for instance, suggested that Cain, who was one of the characters, was the author.
Whoa.
May have taken the title from the sensational 1927 case of Ruth Snyder. Snyder said she had prevented her husband from discovering the changes she had made to his life insurance policy by telling the postman to deliver the policy's payment notices only to her and instructing him to ring the doorbell twice as a signal indicating he had such a delivery for her. Historian Judith Flanders, however, has interpreted the title as a reference to post customs in the Victorian era. When mail, post, was delivered, the postman knocked once to let the householders know it was there. They did not need to reply. When there was a telegram, however, which had to be handed over personally, he knocked twice, so that the household would know they needed to answer the door. Telegrams were expensive and were usually the bringers of bad news, so a postman knocking, later ringing, twice signaled trouble was on the way. Da, 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 da.
You know, Amazon only rings the doorbell once.
But sometimes they hover. I will say that.
I've never seen Amazon hover. Amazon doesn't deliver UPS. No, UPS is the same thing. Well, Amazon is delivered by usually FedEx or an overnight service
It's usually UPS, but okay.
Point being, they ring the doorbell and take off because if you look at the packaging, it says, we'll leave if no one's there.
So back to the novel. Kane wrote that the title of The Postman Always Rings Twice came from a discussion he had had with screenwriter Vincent Lawrence. According to Kane, Lawrence spoke of the anxiety he felt when waiting for the postman to bring him news on a submitted manuscript, specifically noting that he would know when the postman had finally arrived because he always rang twice. With the postman being God or fate, the delivery meant for Frank was his own death as just retribution for murdering Nick. So we're getting into storyline now, which we're not going to get into, but this is from some of the stuff that Connie...
What book was that?
The Postman Always Rings Twice.
Oh.
Frank had missed the first ring when he initially got away with that killing. However, the postman rang again, and this time the ring was heard. Frank is wrongly convicted of having murdered Cora and then sentenced to die. So again, this is from the storyline of the novel. The theme of an inescapable fate is further underscored by the Greek's escape from death in the lover's first murder attempt, only to be done in by their second one. This is the explanation offered in the 1946 film adaptation of the novel. In his biography of Kane, Roy Hoops recounts the conversation between Kane and Lawrence, only he extends Lawrence's remarks. He did not say merely that the postman always rang twice, but rather that he was sometimes so anxious waiting for the postman that he would go into his backyard to avoid hearing his ring. The tactic inevitably failed, Lawrence continued, because if the postman's first ring was not noticed, his second one, even from the backyard, would be. So we have a nice little setting up here. Lisa T. writes, from the title alone, we can infer that bad news from the outside is on its way to Lallybroch. So on to the chapter. We don't know if Ian's told Jenny anything about what happened between Jamie and Randall, but the fact that she wasn't showing anything, meaning in her face, meant nothing, since she's so talented at keeping a straight face and hiding what she's thinking. Lisa T. writes, the chapter begins with Claire wondering how much Ian had told Jenny about Jamie's rape and torture at the hands of BJR. Claire observes that whatever Jenny knew, she treated her brother just as she always had. Quote, one of Jenny's greatest gifts was her ability to see something with utter clarity and then look straight through it as though it wasn't there.
I think she knew.
She knows, if not everything, she knows something went down.
She and Ian are pretty open with each other. I feel like he tells her everything and vice versa.
Connie writes, I take this to mean that Ian may have told Jenny everything Jamie said, but Jenny is content to ignore it, act as though she never heard it, and not let it affect how she treats Jamie. I think it is a gift. So Jenny's baby bump is growing. Oh, the mighty fecund Jenny. Claire is taking over more of the duties, and Janie.
I don't like that word.
Janie?
No, fecund. It makes me think of fecal, which is poop. And clearly that's not what it means, but I'm just saying you said that, and I'm like, oh, poop?
So because Janie, I keep saying Janie. Jenny's getting further along in her pregnancy. Claire is then taking over more of the duties, so that's obviously helping. And sometimes the servants even treat Claire with acceptance and maybe a little awe.
Well, I think that was the goal, though,
for Jenny,
because it was opportune that she. You're right. Oh, it was opportune that she was heavily pregnant when they returned, or on her way to heavily pregnant, because ideally, with Jamie returning, Claire would be the mistress of the house. So it was a nice segue for the servants and the people working in the house to see Claire taking on more responsibility, because as basically the mistress of the house, those are her responsibilities and they should be, even though Jamie, now I'm doing the opposite, even though Jenny had all of those responsibilities since she's been very young.
Connie writes, I'm wondering if any of the stories of La Dame Blanche have reached the Highlands, or is it Claire's Englishness that causes the awe, or her ability to heal, or just what?
She is a force. She is a force, Claire.
I just nodded and I realized you guys can't hear that.
This is not a visual medium. You need to be vocal, please.
And once again, thank goodness. So we're moving fast now from the potato harvest of just a chapter or two ago to Hello Spring. They plant even more potatoes, which survived a hailstorm, while the barley they had planted died. So potatoes and Claire survive. Remember this, dear listener. There are 9 books. Claire is a potato.
I don't think Claire would appreciate that.
Oh, I think so.
Being called a potato?
Connie writes, the second crop of potatoes is planted and survives a hailstorm much better than the barley crop. I think this would make the inhabitants of Lallybroch more in awe of Claire if they're aware that it was her idea to plant potatoes. And that's a good point, too. Ellen G. writes, through the winter, the four of them, Ian and Jenny, Jamie and Claire, wove their way around each other in order to get things done on the farm. Claire never taking Jenny's power from her, as she recognized Jenny's leadership. Then, without too much ado, baby Catherine Mary is born. She comes quickly and without much warning.
Can I tell you, I hella missed that part in the book. Like, I wasn't skim reading, but I must have missed that sentence that happened, because I reached the next chapter when I was doing 35, and all of a sudden they were talking about baby Catherine, and I was like, what? And I had to go back and reread it because I was like, I totally missed that.
And this is why I take notes.
I love your notes.
I love my notes most of the time.
They help you read. It's
quote,
good.
And so the year burgeoned and greened, and I bloomed, the last of my heart's healing in the heart of love and work. Her insides, Claire's emotional health, are healing, just as Master Raymond had healed her, well, insides, physically.
Okay.
Lisa T. writes, the chapter begins from the female perspective of life on a large working farm. It is a complex, ordered domesticity. We read that as Jenny's pregnancy progresses, Claire takes on more of the domestic duties. Jenny and Ian's baby, Catherine Mary, is born easily, quickly, and in perfect health. This is a contrast to Claire's brutal loss of Faith. So, they get lots of mail, although it's not regular.
And no one rang twice.
There was no ring.
Exactly. Do they even have a bell at Lallybroch?
I don't think so.
I will say that there was no bell at the fake Lallybroch that we visited.
Hopeton. House?
That would be the one I'm speaking of.
No. Sorry. Mid-Hope.
Whatever.
Hopeton is the estate. Mid-Hope was the place we went. There was a large package of letters and books. A package from Paris, and they got something from Aunt Jocasta. Yay! I love reading any names that we like have for the rest of the series. I just love it.
Right, but I was a little shocked when he said Auntie Jocasta, or somebody said Auntie Jocasta, and I was like, did anyone call her Auntie? I didn't remember that, so that was new for me.
And Jared, and something from Charles Stewart.
Boo.
Now, Jenny likes books, we learn, like... Jenny likes books, we learn, as Jamie likes horses. So she likes them a lot.
And moderately French.
And she's pretty decently educated for someone who never, I don't think, had a... Well, yeah, she's Alert's daughter.
I loved the statement about the wool walking, where they were like, I have a feeling that the wool walking song sang at Lallybroch had some mixings of French in. The French references. I thought that was clever. Meaning perhaps the wool walkers were a little more educated at Lallybroch than they were in other places.
That's funny. Connie writes, in Costa Rica, we don't have addresses. We have, quote, directions. And the word is still dirección. Okay, that was so fake Spanish, bad French. Excuse me. Dirección, I think. I'm trying to make it all nasal.
Oh, but for real, right now you said that, and now I want to know exactly how you would address an envelope to Costa Rica.
Well, she's going to tell us.
Oh, okay.
even in Spanish-speaking countries that now have addresses, like a house number plus a street name or other designation, the mail carrier has to have a good idea of where people live already or ask other neighbors sometimes how to find the recipient of a piece of mail. Eventually, we will have normal addresses like the rest of the world, I imagine, but these quirks make mail delivery a challenge. In the culture around Lallybroch and Broch Morda at the time, I imagine people didn't pull up stakes and move to another location very often, so that may have made things a bit simpler for whatever the postal carrier had to do to find people and deliver their mail.
All right, so Connie, if you're listening right now, which sometimes you do, so if you're listening right now, DM me your address. I'm going to send you something. I just want to see what your address looks like at this point. Just so I can mail something to you. And I'm also going to throw it through the Google Translator to see exactly what it says.
And now to wool walking. We get a description of it here rather than in Outlander, but I'm so glad they included it in, included that scene in season one of the television series. It worked and it made sense where it was. But Claire does find it positive. Quote, smell aside, the walking shed was a warm, cozy place where the women of Lallybroch visited and joked between bolts of cloth and sang together in the working. And there's a line that sounds a little bit sexual. It's thrusting against a partner, thrusting back.
Well, walking, so sexy with all the piss.
It's possible that elements of the books may appear in just about any order in the TV series. And she's referring to the wool walking, not the exact scene, but a scene appeared in Outlander when it's actually in DIA chapter 34. Lisa T. writes, the peaceful domesticity theme continues, only now from a male perspective. Jamie and Ian come in from the damp weather and are drying off. Claire goes to the kitchen to get something for them to eat when she hears Jamie cry out. This line breaks my heart. Quote, I was in the kitchen when I heard him cry out. I had never heard such a sound from him before. Shock and horror were in it, and something else. A note of finality, like the cry of a man who finds himself seized in a tiger's jaws. End quote. Lisa T. writes, but the postman rang twice. Claire is in the kitchen preparing food when she hears Jamie cry out. It was a letter from his Uncle Jared telling him how proud he was of him. And then there was a broadsheet. On it, King James asserted his right to the thrones of Scotland, England, and Ireland. And it included Jamie's forged signature.
So before you go into any of the listener comments, I'm going to just insert what I had to say about this. This reminds me of receiving packages from Amazon that you don't remember ordering. Like when you... And this happens, I know a lot of people that do this, but like they drink a little bit and then start shopping online. And then the next day, all these packages start arriving. So this to me is very indicative of that to me. It's like, I mean, I know he had nothing to do with it because it was forged and it's not something that he was actually behind. But it's kind of that same feeling of what have I done? Because somebody all of a sudden just like, hey, good job. I'm really proud of you for what you did. And you're like, what did I do? I don't remember this.
And this is what I think of about what you just, from what you just said. What have I done, sweet Jesus, what have I done? Am I a something, something, am I a dog on the run? That's all I remember.
Okay, Les Mis.
There's one little line in there I missed. Cassandra breathes. Of course, I mean Claire. Jenny states the truth. There is only one thing he can do, and that is to fight for Charles and help him win. Lisa T. writes, Jamie says, I'm sorry, I just won't say this easily. J.C., Claire, what am I going to do? It was a cry from the heart and one to which I had no answer. I watched helplessly as he sank onto a hassock and sat staring, rigid, at the fire. Just a quick, interesting note on the definition of hassock. While it is a thick cushion, it is also a cushion for kneeling in prayer. Claire has no answer for Jamie, but Jenny does. She says, you must go and fight for Charles Stewart. You must help him win. Ellen G. writes, the voice of reason or the voice of fate? Is Jenny so focused on the here and now to see what should be done? She doesn't have the more global foresight that Jamie has achieved through Claire and her knowledge of the future. Jamie was in trouble again with the crown, and he had nothing left to do but to go fight. So basically, Jamie is now, once again, after having fought and fought and fought and hidden and done everything for so long, he's again a traitor. The final line of Charles' letter to Jamie is, quote, "Rejoice with me, my dear friend, for I am come home," end quote. If you remember chapter 32, called I Am Come Home, Jamie returns to Lallybroch, while Charles makes a mockery of that.
Stupid Charles. He ruins everything.
What did I say? The royal prick.
Dude. But for real, could you, like, imagine, like, let's just say you're, like, not maybe not your bestie, but somebody who you thought you were really good friends with just, like, incriminates you for something you had nothing to do with. I mean, you just think, I was nothing but kind to that person. And I, you know, took care of them, and I would never have done anything to hurt them. And then I turn my back for 2 seconds, and they're signing my name on the bottom of whatever is going to seal the end of my life. Or what could potentially, you know, be the end of my existence as we know it. So that is chapter 34, The Postman Always Rings Twice. Now we will be moving on to chapter 35, which was entitled Moonlight.
Now, when I first read this title, I thought of the musical Cats. Did you?
No, but I'm not surprised you did.
All alone in the
moonlight. I know what you meant. I know what you meant. You don't need to. You don't need to do that.
Da-da-da,
Ginger.
Da-da-da,
Ginger.
I gotta finish the phrase.
You don't. You really don't. You don't have to. You could have stopped.
No, I had to. I won't sing the whole phrase, but I had to finish that one.
You didn't.
I did.
Nope.
Connie writes, Apollo 8, the first manned mission to the moon, entered lunar orbit on Christmas Eve, 1968. That evening, the astronauts held a live broadcast from lunar orbit in which they showed pictures of the Earth and Moon as seen from their spacecraft. One of the astronauts... What is he doing that for?
Huh?
You're making funny head noises.
No, my neck hurts.
Oh, I thought you were looking at me like I was a doofus.
You are, but that's not what I do.
One of the astronauts said, quote, "The vast loneliness is awe-inspiring, and it makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth," end quote. They ended the broadcast with the crew taking turns reading from the book of Genesis. Moonlight is sufficient for many activities, but not everything. It might also be a metaphor for how uncertain the future is for Jamie and Claire. So the estate prepares for its laird and men to go to war. We find out that they are, I mean, I guess they're expensive and it makes sense, especially with if the metal weapons, it makes sense. You know, why would you get rid of something if it works? You just don't use it. You go put it away or store it somewhere. But they're getting ready some of the weapons from that they still have around from the rising of 1715. This is like 30 years ago now. And it's August, so we've been through quite a cycle. This is like a lot happens in the last, or a lot of time passes in the last chapter and this chapter. So August, you remember what happened last August?
No.
They were in France. She had her miscarriage the previous May, and she and Jamie met in the orchard, or in the, not the orchard, what do you call it? In the...
The garden?
The
arbor?
Arbor. I'm like, the arboretum? No. So Jenny and Jamie chat in the brew house. Apparently, it's very alcoholic-y, the very air. Jamie says he could get drunk just by breathing. Let me tell you, thank goodness that doesn't happen, does it? I mean, have you ever been in a situation where you... I've gotten a little heady on some fumes, but not by anything like I've done on purpose, but like being in and around something.
I mean, I've never done it on purpose, but I mean, I've had some strongly scented Sharpies that have sent me into a little giddiness. But I mean, I'm not huffing paint or nothing.
So Jenny wants Jamie to take Ian with him. She knows it's dangerous, but she's afraid that if he doesn't go, he won't feel a whole man, and she'd rather have him whole than home and not whole. She knows very well how dangerous it is. She was the one who'd mended Ian when he'd come home from France with the missing leg. Lisa T. writes, just as in chapter 34, we saw the female and male perspectives of pastoral domesticity, we are now beginning to see the female and male perspective of war. Both the women and men are part of the fight, but in their own ways. We also begin to see Jenny as a healer as well, a role that is usually Claire's. Lisa T. writes, just as in chapter 34 we saw the female and male perspectives of pastoral domesticity, we are now beginning to see the female and male perspective of war. Both the women and men are part of the fight, but in their own ways. We also begin to see Jenny as a healer as well, a role that is usually Claire's. Ian is whole to Jenny, and that's why he's happy with her and the kids. But if he's of no use to Jamie, he won't be whole to himself. Lisa T. writes, we know that she has done this with Ian despite his missing leg. She sees him as being whole. She now does the same for Jamie. We are beginning to understand Jenny's ability to heal others.
I don't know if it's as much of a healing thing or because he's already, quote unquote, healed. It's more of a let's keep him that way as she's trying to make sure that everything she's done from his injury to present is not for naught. So that she's like, you know, I brought him back from a maggot ridden nothing. And I want you to help me maintain that. And the only way for him to maintain and continue to be the person that he is for you to make him feel like he is just as useful and just as meaningful to you as any other member of this area.
So basically, don't you dare take away his manhood.
Don't take his manhood and don't ruin what I've spent years cultivating.
Him.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because you will do the damage that you think you're actually trying not to do.
Right.
Jamie points
it's
out
pride. It's all pride.
Oh yeah. Jamie points out that this fight will be different.
He's like, if you send him, he will die. It's possible.
Either way. Oh no. Either way, he's going to die.
Yeah. Even if we succeed, if we don't succeed, the odds are not in his favor. The odds are in none of our favors.
If they come out on the wrong side, it's treason. That means almost certain death. So Jamie agrees that he will speak with Ian and take him. And I wonder if he was talked into it, if he felt pressured or what. And then later on, I don't think I made a note of it, so I'll say it here. When I finished taking notes on the chapter, I realized, you know what? He, from his own volition, he would not have wanted Ian, right? We know that because Jenny had to talk to him.
It's not that he wouldn't have wanted Ian.
No, I mean, he didn't want him. He wanted him to be safe. He didn't want him to be out there where it was dangerous and he was at a disadvantage more than anyone almost.
Agreed. I'll go with that.
And he wanted to save him, basically. And to agree with Jenny or to agree to take him was probably difficult, but he did it. I finally decided the reason he did it was to honor his sister. I mean, obviously there was Ian involved in that, but he did it out of love for his sister.
Oh, he didn't want to do it. Not even a little bit.
But I was wondering, did she convince him? I mean, you could make the argument that she convinced him because he ended up saying yes, but I don't think it was like, oh, twist my arm, fine, you win. I think it was he did it for her.
Yeah, I think he saw the logic of her request. You know what I mean? I think that even though the long and the short of it was that he didn't want Ian to be hurt and he wanted Ian to be home and to help take care of Jenny and the farm and everything else, I think that he ultimately did it to make Jenny happy.
Yes, because I thought Jenny, I mean, she had a good argument, don't get me wrong, but Jenny was making it about Ian, right? Jenny was saying, don't take this away from him. It was about her too. I will not have him not be whole. I want him to keep his manhood, keep his pride, and be a whole person. But she made it about him being whole. She didn't say one time, although you could read it between every single line, she never said, I want myself and my marriage and my home to be whole. But that is exactly what it leads to.
Well, she wanted him to be whole not only for himself, but for her. I mean, it wasn't completely selfless, but I mean, everyone would benefit from him being a whole person. So, I mean, it's for the good of all, I think.
So now Jamie and Ian talk. Ian is upset that Jamie seems to be ordering him to accompany him to war. He goes from incredulousness to suspicion and then to anger. Now Jamie tells him he knows he's a good fighter and he would trust him. Jamie tries to order him and that doesn't work. He tries flattery and Ian dismisses this. His concern, of course, lies with Jenny and the Bairns. And he says, I'm not even going to try to like pronounce the Gaelic here, but he basically says, kiss my ass, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And Jenny grasps Claire's hand as they are on the couch. And so all of this, remember, is in front of family. Claire and Jenny are sitting on the couch and Jamie and Ian are chatting it up. Jamie and Ian first fight it out verbally, and then they arm wrestle. And meanwhile, Jenny's rolling her eyes that they're, man, they got to do this. They got to, like, show they're tougher than the other or stronger than the other. And then Jamie and Ian, in the midst of this arm wrestling, break out into laughter. Jamie then does the same thing he'd done when Ian had been injured when his wooden leg stepped into a molehole. He ordered him to take rest and go to bed, and then asked him to do it for him. This time, however, Ian said no. As Ian considers...
He said no angrily, like, are you kidding me? I'm crippled and I'm broken. Why would you want me? I need to stay here.
As Ian considers, though is he really? I don't know about this yet. As Ian considers this, he looks intently at Jenny. The entire time, he's rolling his sleeve down. She flushes deeply. And I think at this point, he's realizing, because Jenny's like showing her embarrassment in her face. Her blood rushes to her head. And Ian's like, woman, I love you, but what are you doing? He says he'll stay. The family needs her. Huh? Sorry. He says he'll stay. The family needs him there. He says, I shall stay here. Garden your weak side, man. Now, he was known for guarding his literal weak side, his left side.
That statement made me a little angry. Because, let's be honest, Jenny is by no means weak.
Well,
ever.
But, okay, so let's wait for that.
Okay.
So what it meant, besides in this context, was Jamie's right side, right?
Yes.
Okay, in battle, that's where it started. You can look at what he meant in this context by his weak side. I think, obviously, you can look at Jenny and the family, but he also was looking at Claire. He pointedly looked at Claire. He maybe assumed that Claire would stay back because she was a woman. So maybe that was part of it. And while Claire is also not weak, she is a woman. And in those times, you know, women during war, they could potentially be the spoils of war. It was believed they did not belong on a battlefield. So he's definitely including Jenny. I think potentially including Claire in that statement. And of course, all the babies. But if you take a wider look at that, in a wider aspect, you could say potentially that home, like home and hearth, those whom he loved, they bring you great joy, great comfort, and they bring you strength, right? They bring you hope, I think, when you're out there. But they are also a weakness, meaning, and I'm not saying this would ever happen, but meaning that you kind of go soft for them. You know what I mean? Emotionally.
Well, think about it, though. The only reason that Jamie allowed Blackjack Randall to bugger him was because Claire was mixed in. I think he would have fought a tooth and nail and let Randall kill him if Claire had not been a bargaining chip. So your greatest loves are also your greatest weaknesses if you have them there and they are in jeopardy. And having Claire there would definitely make things, you know, heighten things.
Connie writes, I will be interested to see how they work this into the episode, since TV Jamie doesn't have the, quote, weak side of a left-handed book Jamie. I believe the guarding your weak side line is iconic, but I wonder if it will make it into the TV series. Do you think so? I think it's hard without there being a need to be protected by Ian. All we have is that they grew up together, they fought together. That doesn't change.
Well, his weak side would be different anyway because he's not cack-handed in the show.
Yeah, but there's almost not really a need for it because it's not just that he was left-handed in the book. It was that 99% of the rest of the population of fighters were right-handed. And thus that did put him at
a disadvantage.
Yeah. So most people don't need someone to cover their weak side because everybody has the same weak side.
Exactly. Well, that's kind of what I'm saying. And that would be something that would be necessary had they followed through with that in the show, but because they didn't, it might be irrelevant. But it's such a touching thing to say.
Oh, it definitely
is. Such a big part of the relationship between the two of them in the novels.
But if I remember correctly, what we know of Ian from season 1, there was nothing in there except them growing up together and them fighting together and being like brothers, right? Nothing in there about, they were there for each other and supported each other and protected each other, but there was nothing about, I must support you for this, right? Nothing. because there was no need for it.
Yes.
Ellen G. writes, this is not what Jenny wanted her brother to do to get Ian to go to war. Ian seemed to know that this was Jenny's doing, as he looked over at her when he was rolling down his sleeve and before he told Jamie that he is needed at Lallybroch.
He may not have wanted it, but not in those terms. However, it did allow him to be
the man
who says, I'm not coming with you, screw you, and not the man who's left behind.
You know, and I wonder if Jenny actually knew he wouldn't go.
But I'm sure but she this hoped whole, he wouldn't.
This whole thing, she could have, maybe was orchestrated by her. Maybe she planned for it to go this way. Because what it allowed him to do, even if he was, you know, momentarily embarrassed, it allowed him to save face greatly. And, well, not publicly, but in the family, everyone was clear that it was his decision. Look, I am not going. It was his decision, right? Even though he thinks he knows that, of course, and he's right, that Jenny, that this was Jenny's doing. I wouldn't be surprised. I wonder if Jenny knew this would be the outcome and wanted to give him this opportunity to turn it down.
Well,
because if nothing else, that would make his, that would keep his pride intact as well.
Absolutely. But I mean, clearly she doesn't really want him to go. She doesn't want him to be in jeopardy, but she doesn't want to keep a man behind on the farm who's going to regret and bemoan not being included in something. So it, regardless of the intent behind it, I think, you know, she got exactly the reaction she needed and or wanted from the interaction. So success to Jenny.
I agree that this line is iconic, but I think here, if they do use it, it could also be made to mean guarding the family.
But
the thing is,
upset when I think that that's him saying it's his weak side. I mean, I found that statement to be a little offensive.
Okay, take it up with Diana.
All right, Diana. I don't know. You and me, we're going to have a tete-a-tete.
No, you're going to have an arm wrestle.
She'll win. Clearly she'll win. I need
you
to work
are
out.
Like a foot taller than her. No.
I may be, like, but she's like, inches. She's steel. Woman is steel. I need to do more push-ups if I want to actually, you know, engage in an arm wrestle with her.
So even though I think the line is iconic and it would be great to hear, but without the backbone of the line, meaning without the line having a backbone, right? Right now in the books, the line has a backbone. It has a purpose. It has to do with what they did since childhood, since what Jamie's father,
Ian's father
told Ian to do. There's a lot of history there, and without that, which we don't have, and the handedness,
the handedness?
Yeah, that's a word.
Meaning what?
Which hand do you use?
Okay. I was like, what?
Without the left-handedness conversation, the line kind of loses its meaning. So I honestly don't know if it will be used. And it would make sense that it wouldn't, because I think it would be weird if they included it, don't you?
Well, there's no background to that would have been something they should have started establishing from the first series season. I just got all like BBC on this.
So in bed that night, Diana uses a word that I love. Actually, two words in this chapter. Two words in this chapter that stuck out to me, because I love moon stuff, was she used the term moon bright, like sunlight, bright by the light of the moon, moon bright. And also, I think Jamie used the term moonset. Mm. Isn't that pretty? So moonbright in the room. So it's a room lit up by the moon.
The moon.
Once Ian had decided to stay, Jamie began making solid plans and giving orders. Jamie had to decide who would go and who would stay, each according to his family situation and for the good of the estate. Jamie had no choice now but to fight, but Claire still had her knowledge. Charles Stuart had only arrived in Scotland with 7 companions, and his entire armament consisted of a number of broadswords. And they get this information from Jared, who in one of his letters is recounting basically how the prince got from France to Scotland and what the progress had been up to that point. They learn a bit of information from Jared, and the rest of the information, quote, from the Highland Grapevine, which I loved.
It's very reliable.
Oh my gosh.
The Highland Grapevine.
So the Camerons are the first clan to join the Stuart cause. Jamie had banned women from joining them, from joining the men who were leaving to go to war. He knew that he had no chance of leaving Claire behind, though. He decides to take Fergus, though. Fergus, he points out, does not belong at Lallybroch, and neither in France, but rather with Jamie. Later that night in the hallway, Jamie and Claire hear baby Catherine, who was teething and, you know, kind of fussing and keeping people awake. Jamie got up and was walking her in the hallway, and he tells Jenny that he'll see to her and she should get some sleep. Claire hears Jamie humming tunelessly to baby Catherine. Claire thinks, quote, "One day perhaps he would hold his own child so, and thus he would sing to his own daughter a tuneless song, a warm, soft chant in the dark," end quote. Claire knows that she will be able to have another child, and she says faith's gift to her was knowledge that she could conceive. Claire drifts to sleep listening to Jamie and the baby. When she wakes up again, the moon is all the way up, and Jamie is no longer singing, but speaking quietly to Catherine in Gaelic in very low tones. And in the moonlight, Claire could see the silent tears tracking down his cheeks. Connie writes, "I just know I'm gonna cry."
Like, I don't think she wrote it quite like that.
No, that's my intonation, but she did use an exclamation point and she did write gonna. So I think I'm pretty close. And Connie, if they include this, we certainly will. I mean, 100%. Come on. I cry at the opening. I am hopeless
when it comes to Outlander. You cry at lots of stuff.
Seriously, dude. It doesn't get better with age, does it?
No.
Probably gets worse with age. Does,
no, just, I promise you, if you ever decide to have kids one day, it gets worse
You know
that.
What? As far as I know, I'm not capable of parthenogenesis, so it's not that I'm just going to decide and boom, have a baby. It takes a little work.
So you're not like an amoeba who just, you know.
That's not.
Well, you just self-procreate.
Oh,
I mean, that's
no,
all you're going with,
that's
right?
That's asexual reproduction, right?
Then what's parthenogenesis?
It's when...
Don't just throw a word out there and not tell me what it means.
It's when fertilization occurs with... Of like, an embryo occurs... Brickers?
Like spontaneously?
It occurs without the introduction of... Okay, let me look it up.
But then shouldn't that fall in line with asexual reproduction?
According to Wikipedia, Oh, I think I left out a... Yeah, sorry. I said partho. It's partheno. I knew it. I thought it had a few more syllables. Parthenogenesis is a form... Oh, okay. It's a form of asexual reproduction.
Exactly.
In which growth and development of embryos occur without fertilization. In animals, parthenogenesis means development of an embryo from an unfertilized egg cell and is a component process of apomixis. So no, my point is, I'll say that again. I don't think I am capable of parthenogenesis.
I'm sure if you were, you would have done so by now.
You know, even then, I don't think it's necessarily a decision. But so the next morning, Claire wakes up and the baby is in bed with them. It is so cute with their little butt in the air.
Well, she doesn't start with the butt in the air.
No.
She starts face to face with
and holding
with
her
Claire
hair
and then like flips over.
Lisa T writes, "When Claire wakes in the morning, there is a quote warm, unfamiliar scent." Unquote, end quote. Me and this unquote, end quote, seriously, next to her. It is sleeping baby kitty. "Good morning, Sassnach," Jamie says. "You look very sweet, the two of you, asleep face to face like that." This is such a beautiful scene, Lisa T. writes. It reminds me of the scene in chapter 28 when Jamie is comforting Claire after Faith's death, and he says, quote, "But with the grace of God, I might give you another," end quote. Even though Kitty isn't their child, it feels as though Jamie, bringing sleeping Kitty into their bed, is making a symbolic gesture toward giving Claire another child. Jamie gets some much-needed sleep, and Claire takes the hungry baby down to Jenny. Lisa T. writes, "The last part of the chapter is one of my favorites. Diana finds such truth in the most basic of human experiences. Baby Catherine is awake and crying. Jamie offers to take her for the night because he can't sleep either. Claire listens to Jamie and Kitty walking up and down the hall. She hopes that one day he will hold his own daughter. Quote, the constant small ache in my heart was submerged in a flood of tenderness. I had conceived once. I could do so again. Faith had given me the gift of that knowledge. Jamie, the courage and means to use it. end quote. So just as we see Jenny moving into the role of the healer, Claire is beginning to move into the role of a mother, more into Jenny's role. We learn that Jamie is not sleeping well these days. Jenny tells Claire that you really can talk to babies. She heard Jamie the night before and tells her that it isn't as though he can't talk to her, but that talking to a babe is different.
I imagine that it would be very similar to talking to your pets.
Well, then I got this.
I know, because
I got this all.
They're not going to remember most of the time. They don't judge you. So it's like that person that you can just pour your heart out to, who's not going to turn around and be like, I can't believe you just said that, or that's the silliest thing you've ever said. So you feel that freedom to literally just say anything. I mean, I have some actual adult best friends that I have that kind of a relationship with. I would never tell them I would talk to them like I talk to babies, but yeah, it's a very special thing to have somebody you can talk to and just know that you can literally say anything and not be concerned that they're going to turn around and be like, whoa, I feel totally different about you now and we can't be friends.
The thought of the child, this is Jenny's description. The thought of the child, when they're still inside you, you talk to them as if, and you think it's different once they're born, she says. It becomes what is. Jenny says it's the grieving of the unborn child that you feel even while holding the born in your hands. Claire says, quote, yes, before it's all possibility. It might be a son or a daughter, a plain child, a bonny one, and then it's born, and all the things it might have been are gone, because now it is, end quote. The daughter is born, and the son that might have been is dead.
Now, this doesn't happen very often today, because everyone gets their babies sexed. That sounds weird, but when they go and they do the...
Speaking of sexed, Summer, I don't know if we put... I think we put it out on Twitter, right? I don't think I put it on Facebook. That
I don't know.
We had some
this.
Guinea pig issues recently. Fergus and...
Henry.
Ended up being Fergus and Henrietta when Summer goes in one morning to feed them, and there are five instead of two. So obviously there was some kind of messing up by the breeder. Anyway, in hopes of having at least one, because the baby's daddy, Fergus, has to be fixed if we're gonna keep him. So he will be fixed. Was he already fixed?
No, he was not. I did get him fixed.
Wait, he's fixed now?
He's fixed now.
Okay, sorry. This whole thing is so fast. So he's fixed now. He's being kept separately.
Well, it has to be fast because apparently after a mom gives birth, they can be immediately reimpregnated.
Okay.
Immediately.
Well, but he's already been kept. He's being kept separate from the babies.
I separated them.
For their safety. But
for mom's safety.
I just didn't know if you had done that. So yeah, he's been fixed. And at the vet's, while his checkup or something, she took all the baby, and the mama. Just the whole family went.
The point is, here's what happened. My
we
goal,
had to find
my hope,
out.
My hope was that there would be a
girl
so that I could keep one of the female guinea pigs, babies, and then not only have to get one of them fixed and only have to pay for one neutering, because if there was two females and one fixed male, there would be no more
babies.
It's
all good.
And when we went to get them sexed by the vet, we found out that we were gifted with three male guinea pigs.
So seriously, people, the twists and turns of this story, I mean, it's not that twisty-turny, but the twists and turns of this little guinea pig story are you couldn't write this stuff. So first of all, it's two males. Nope, surprise, it's five. Babe, it's five total. And then we're like, surely out of three, you'll have one girl. Nope, all male. So it's just more and more interesting. So anyway,
the
whole point I bring up was the word, when you said sexed, I'm like, okay, we got to talk about this. The guinea pigs had to be sexed. And so now we know we have three males.
Well, technically now I have four males.
Well, I'm talking about babies.
Oh, okay.
But those babies, apparently it was difficult to observe and hear. And probably for the babies, not that fun. So Summer, you can't just on a cat, you just hold up the tail and say, oh, you're a dot, or oh, you're a dot dot. I don't know. You got a little winky. No. What does it happen? What does it take for a guinea pig sexing?
Guinea pig sexing. Okay. Guinea pigs genitalia.
If it were a female, what would you see?
Guinea pig genitalia is predominantly almost exclusively internal.
Even the girls?
They look the same.
All girls
they
are
almost
internal.
Look the same. Now, when I was reading on a website, they made it sound like the difference between the two was what amounted to a dot.
Isn't it always?
Exactly. And while there were dots present on all of them. That was not satisfactory for the vet. She felt the need to express.
Oh, that word is just wrong.
It's what happened.
Express is like milk.
It was real close to that. Like, oh, it was like she was popping a blackhead.
Oh, Summer. Oh, Lord have mercy.
You asked.
I didn't ask about expression. Just say you got to, like, wiggle something.
No, there was no wiggling. It wasn't wiggling. She had to push it out.
Okay.
Push. You could say that. But it had to be pushed out. It had to be pushed out to an extent. Like, she kept pushing even after it started to, you know, come out. So maybe even female guinea pigs have a little bit of stuff to push out, but she pushed it out till a specific target occurred.
Oh, good
to
crazy.
When she felt confident in stating that they were, in fact, all three boys. None of them liked it. So they all were very unhappy to be messed with at that point. And Mama didn't like hearing the distress. So it was a very stressful visit for everyone concerned. That being said, my whole point was, is that during that time period, you would not know the sex of the baby until after it was born. So, but today, in today's now day and age, that moment of the loss or the death of a girl child if you have a boy and a boy child if you have a girl.
Okay, so finally Summer's bringing
I was trying Summer's, to. You took me on a
thank
journey.
You. Thank
you took
you.
Me on a journey. But my point
thank
is,
you for bringing
is
us
that
back.
That death that she speaks of happens in utero now. Because, oh. For instance, when I was
earlier,
pregnant,
yeah.
And you go to your 20-week ultrasound, and that's when they can see whether or not it's a boy or a girl, while they also look for to make sure the heart is maturing adequately and their brain looks great and their body has everything it's supposed to have. They also can generally tell the sex of the baby. And we went into that ultrasound. I think I was hoping for a boy, but only because, not that I have anything against girls. I'm a girl. I think girls are awesome. Only because...
Whoa, try that again.
Only because, you know, I'm one of two babies. Me and my sister are it. We didn't have any brothers or sisters. Well, we didn't have any other brothers or sisters. There were definitely no brothers, but it was just the two of us, two girls. And I always thought how awesome it would have been to have an older brother. So going into having my first child, I thought how cool it would be to have a boy first. So, you know, we kind of thought it would be awesome if there was a boy. And then my daughter ended up not being a boy. She was very clearly a girl. And at first I was a little like, oh, well, it's not a boy then. And then I thought, there's so many cute clothes out there for girls. And I got over it almost immediately. But I did actually have that moment of not remorse or regret or anything like that. Just that moment of, you know, all of those things that I thought we could do with a little boy were not going to happen now. So, I mean, I can see that.
What, like football?
I mean, clearly I'm not into football and I don't care about tossing a football around. And my ex-husband was not into football, so that was never an issue. So, no.
Okay.
Maybe suits and ties, little like suspenders. I have no idea what I thought I was going to do with a little boy. I still wouldn't know what I'd do with a little boy.
I don't know. I don't know what I would do with a little boy, but I do know if I have my one child, it's going to be a boy. I've just known this. Our dad agrees with me. Isn't that weird to say our dad?
That sounds so gross. Please don't ever say that again.
Why would our dad agrees with me?
About what kind of baby you're going to produce? It's weird. It's weird.
If I have a child, I almost expressed, and now I can't use that term. I have expressed before in front of our father, our mutual father, that, you know, I may have one kid. Who knows? If I have one kid, I just have a feeling it's going to be a boy. I just have this feeling. And he said, I agree with you.
That's weird. It's weird that you think that.
And we had this conversation. I've said this a few times, whoever listened. But I said this to our father, or I should say this conversation where he agreed with me. And it could have just been to shut me up.
I mean, I end many a conversation with you saying things that I think will shut you up.
But this was in the hospital when you were in labor.
Okay, I was not part of that conversation.
No,
but that's weird.
It was in the hallway. You were just like sleeping or pushing or something.
I was doing neither of those things in the hallway.
No, in the bedroom.
I was not in a bedroom. I was in a labor and delivery room.
In that room, in the hospital room. Dad and I were in the hallway. So,
you big weirdos.
You just made me snot myself. Stop it. So for men, Jenny says, they hold their bairns. feel the things that might be and the things that will never be, but it isn't so easy for a man to weep for the things he doesn't know. Lisa T. points out, but Jamie did weep for Faith.
I thought you said, but Jamie. And I was like, what's that?
Lisa T. points out, but Jamie did weep for Faith, the past, and the terrifying unknown of the future.
Do you think he would have been so moved if it had been a boy child?
Or did the
fact that it was a girl baby and Faith?
Because of Faith? Yeah. Oh, sure.
If he was just like, if that just brought everything.
I never considered the fact that he was sad over Faith. Isn't that like that's the whole point?
Right, exactly. It's okay. People, she has cats.
Okay. Don't say it like that. Cats are sweet.
They are.
Well, mine are sweet.
If you had real babies, you might have considered.
I have monkey babies.
I'm just saying, if you'd had human babies, you might have considered that would be the first thing that came to mind.
That he was
mourning the loss of his own child.
No,
looking
if
at
I
his,
were a good
niece.
Fan and reader on top of my game, I would have realized. And we've talked about Faith like every third word. Well, every 60th word. Connie writes, I had a sonogram when I was 9 days from delivering my son, back when sonograms were still pretty new, and my doctor just had gotten her machine that morning and wanted to try it out on me. I didn't want to know whether my baby was a boy or a girl until birth, and she didn't tell me. I realized that times have changed and gender reveal parties or announcements are now a thing, but the possibility and the mystery, in my opinion, are just a little diminished by having so much information before the baby even arrives. Now, I know there are lots of opinions on this, and I've known for at least a good 9 months or since about earlier this year, anyway, in the spring, I've heard of gender reveal parties, but I did not know that was a thing now until earlier this year. Did you know about those?
Gender reveal parties? They're all over the place.
Well, I know, but I mean, I don't have a lot of friends anymore who are popping them out. So.
I mean, I didn't have one. They're super popular now. I see them online
and
everything.
It is the thing. Yeah, it's the thing. If you had another child, would you want to do a gender reveal party? Or just like, are you a little old for that?
I'm a little old for a lot of things. I don't know. It could be fun, but I mean, the whole point behind gender reveal parties is a lot of times it's a surprise to the parents as well. Like they get the answer put in like an envelope, and then they take that to like a bakery and they're like, "Bake me a cake with the color of whatever's inside of this envelope
as fast as you can. Don't look now."
It's a gingerbread man. No, we're not doing that. My point is that it's almost, I don't know. I think it's just as exciting to find out while looking at the ultrasound. Other than a cake. I mean,
you know, I'll answer the question that I asked you. On the one hand, like seriously, 75 to 85% of me is on the side of for me, not for anybody else. For me, don't find out, right? If I had a kid, don't find out because it is. It's one of life's last true mysteries.
But it's just as big of a surprise during the ultrasound as it is when the baby comes out of your body.
That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm saying wait the whole time. However, since I'm no longer a 20-something, and if I do have a child, it would likely be my one and only. You know what? Ain't nobody got time for that. I want to know the stuff so I can get the stuff and be prepared with the stuff for the person it's going to be. You're not going to know the person, but you can at least know the sex. And I'm like, you know what? I like the idea of waiting and finding out and the mystery and the romantic of that. I get it. But the older I get before I have it, if I have it, I'm just like, I need to be more practical, right? That's how I feel. It would depend on my husband. It's not just me.
No, I mean, I can see that. I liked knowing ahead of time. It gave me more time to consider names. It gave me more time to consider bedding and room things that we wanted to do with her bedroom. It gave me time to stockpile clothing. I mean, I don't know. The modern science is awesome. Why don't we use it more? I mean,
oh, no, people do. That's not the question. This is not the question of why shouldn't.
I mean, you can know. The thing is all of these people in the olden days didn't know because they couldn't know. But I think if they had the opportunity to know the way that we know now, they would totally take advantage of it because it's practical.
Depending, maybe for like upper class where, you know, having that boy, right? Or, well, even at Lallybroch, having a boy was so important to pass on the the family name and everything, the lairdship. I could see for especially families that had that. Not that others wouldn't want to know, but for people who had the fortunes or whatever, the kings, queens, nobles, whatever. I could see them definitely wanting to know, but quite frankly, so many people for so long had so many children that they had the hand-me-downs from, if not from their other kids, then they had, so it really wouldn't, I'm not talking for like number one, I'm talking like for number seven or eight, right? At that point, it matters because they are a human being and it's special every time, but it's not about shopping and being ready. Names, maybe.
I mean, but that's that.
But that's back then.
That's the same now, though. Even once you've had one of each, it's irrelevant. And I think that I know a lot of people who have like more than two children that by the time they've had one of each, they're just like, I don't care, whatever it is, it's fine. I'm not even going to find out because it's not going to change things one way or the other. So I mean,
but they have clear reasons for that. Is what you're saying?
Yeah,
reasons for wanting to know or not wanting to know.
Right.
Ellen G. writes. An interesting take of postpartum depression. Speaking to your unborn child, and when it comes out, it is not the child you spoke to, but someone else. Interesting take of postpartum depression. Speaking to your unborn child, and when it comes out, it is not the child you spoke to, but someone else. You can love them the same, but it is not the same as before. Before it is born, it is all possibility, and when it is born, it just is. Wow, this is the beginning of the end of this arc in the book. It foretells so much. Readying for war, dividing your people, who will attend you and who will stay. Getting your weapons ready and speaking of the unknown to babes. Beautiful. Quote, but it isna so easy for a man to weep for things he doesna ken. End quote.
You know what I think you mourn the most when you have a baby and it comes out of your body and it's
your
no
sleep.
Longer inside of you? Exactly. Quiet. You mourn the quiet. You mourn the moments when the babies were just constantly always taken care of by being inside of you. They're muffled by everything. You don't hear them crying. You don't hear anything. You don't have to change diapers. You don't have to do anything like that. Everything is taken care of inside of your womb. And the minute they come out, it's like, do this, do that, do this. No, sleep is not an option for you anymore. Everything that you thought was part of what made you who you are is irrelevant. You need to focus on this being. And I think that you kind of mourn the autonomy of that, the fact that you aren't being relied on 100% by this little being. And as lovely as they are, and as much as you love and don't and love doing those things for them, there is that part of you that's just like, things were so much easier when it was inside.
And I've also heard that, and this is something that I don't believe you have experience with either, is that going from one child to two children, you also mourn something, right? So when you have one child, it's just you and this happy little family. And then, but even as up until the end, up until the end of your pregnancy, when that child sleeps or has a nap, if it's young, right, then you can take a nap. So before you have any kids, you nap when you nap, as long as you're not tremendously ill. And once you have the kid, you're like on its schedule. But then if you get pregnant again while the kid is, under like five or six, I guess, there's at least some hope of being able to take a nap or get stuff done when that child is kind of like resting.
Forget the nap. Let's stop talking about naps. You know what you miss? And I don't have two children, but I think that what I would miss if I did have two was the intimacy.
Oh, yeah.
The intimacy of the relationship that I have with my daughter, because it's just her and I, that if a third party became involved, that I would fear that it would diminish. And it would, I mean, it would clearly change the nature of the relationship between you and the first child that you had, especially if, it's been you and that one child for, I've been just me and my daughter for, 7 years now. But I would mourn that. I would mourn that relationship that we had that was so close and there was nothing else like it. And then, everyone says, when you have a second child, you don't realize how much your heart just grows and you have room to love them both in equal and maybe not completely equal, but they always say it's an equal in an equal way. I can't deny or verify that at this point, but you make room. You find a way to have just as much love for that other child as you do for your first. But I would fear that it would change things. And I think I would mourn that in some ways.
So I think that kind of wraps
up. That's it. That's chapter 35. Yeah. That was Moonlight. Please join us back for our next chapter discussion, wherein Join us back. Oh my gosh, you guys, that was the end of part five. We would be moving into part six entitled The Flames of Rebellion. And this is the beginning of the end, people. The beginning of the end of the Highlanders in the Jacobite society. So join us back when we discuss our next chapter discussion, which will be chapter 36, entitled Preston Pans.
So this will be the last episode for 2015, Summer.
Another year come and gone.
Oh, my Lord. This is our third holiday episode. Holiday time episode.
This is our third Christmas together, people.
I know. We're getting older.
And our third New Year.
Yep, that too.
So, I mean, I feel like we all know each other a little better. We've been, you know, becoming closer. And I in my heart of hearts, hope that we have at least
10 more years.
I don't know. Do you think there's going to be 10 more books?
Oh, gosh. Well, made to screen.
No, not 10 more books. I mean, that's only our book two.
I
know.
Well, eight more then.
Eight more. We'll
minimum
say eight.
Well, there are nine. She's working on nine now.
And she says we're hoping for a 10th. So we're hoping
she
for
at least. She said that?
I think she says there was at least one more book inside of her.
Oh, my gracious. Well, may she remain ever youthful and healthy until she's 180. And may our stars, thank God, what she's reading. You know, okay, if you're listening to this, this is not a spoiler. So if you have not read DIA, at least the first, 10 chapters, you know, then go away. Because this is a spoiler. But I'm pretty sure you're safe. Even though it kicks you in the patook, kicks you in the feels, whatever. And people have damned this and hated it and thrown books across rooms for 20 plus years, right? Even though it is one of the biggest tragedies of this, of the entire saga, the entire epic story of Jamie and Claire, that though we don't know exactly what happens because we're not to the end of the book yet, in case you're reading this along with us and you have not finished, we know by the beginning, right, when DIA opens, that Claire is back in the 20th century. So obviously something had to happen that she had to end up there.
Okay.
One of the greatest things, especially for actors, for our actors, one of the greatest fortunes I think that we as fans have is that it's only in Outlander and Dragonfly and Amber that they're relatively young. After that, they're super aged. Not old.
They're super aged.
No, I mean, it's like, they're not old, 20 but
years?
It's been 20 years. That's a lot of aging to do in one book.
Though, to be honest, I've had a lot of aging since the first time I read the first book. So I feel like I'm on par with Claire.
We both have. So all that to say, I'm so glad that the rest of the series after this book is in tandem with that age change, right? And of course, since they're not going back in time, they're getting older. And so I think it's great because our actors will never not be able to fit the roles, is what I'm saying. Because the characters only get older. They don't have to, our characters age. What I'm saying is the book age. If the books were like so close in time that at some point,
if they were vampires,
if
they were vampires, there's a finite period of time that they could maintain the outward appearance of like 20 something.
So maybe not 10 years. Yeah, no.
The point is because of the steep jump in age,
because
think that
Jamie
we can
and Claire are not vampires.
They are not. And that could maybe be your title. Jamie and Claire are not vampires.
That's what I was thinking.
Point is, we are definitely set up by the nature of the story and the structure of the story to be able to maintain the current actors for the foreseeable future. So kudos to Diana for, without even knowing it, writing a story that would perpetuate some great actors' careers and not require recasting.
So I think we'll wrap it up here.
We should.
We hope your holidays continue. Don't laugh at me, please.
I'm already laughing.
We hope your holidays continue to sparkle.
Oh, God.
I knew that was coming.
Like Edward in the Twilight.
Oh, gosh.
Because we were talking about vampires.
Oh, my goodness. So
it's a sparkling New Year.
May your holidays sparkle, and may you have a very, and my cat's joining me, a very, very happy New Year.
With sparkles and glitter and rainbows and unicorns.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our first podcast of 2016.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.